I had students who would come in and say, I'm not creative. And, you know, you just think, well, how could this be? You're a human being. Of course you are. So it's, you have to dismantle those ideas of creativity that are unhelpful so people can learn to trust their own inherent creativity.
Welcome to Talking Creativity, the Crania podcast from Dublin City University. I'm Ciarán Dunn.
I'm Joe Binetti.
And I'm Tim Hannigan. In this series, we talk to academic experts on creativity, creative practitioners, people from the creative industries and the arts, and those working across disciplines and at the boundaries between scholarship and practice.
The aim of these conversations is to dig into creativity, to figure out what it means, and above all, to explore ways to encourage it in any field or discipline.
The Crania Project is based at Dublin City University and funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education.
For today's episode, we're travelling to Bulgaria to speak to writers Will Buckingham and Hannah Stevens, both originally from the UK, but currently based in Sofia. The conversation covers many weird and wonderful things. Studio spaces for creative writing, zapping conventional assessment culture with magic wands, life in the unruly illuminated margins of academia, and much more besides. Will is a writer and academic with a very broad range. He has a master's in anthropology, a PhD in philosophy, and his many books span the gamut from travel writing to children's fiction, though with a particularly strong component dealing with ideas from philosophy. Until 2016, he was associate professor in writing and creativity at De Montfort University in Leicester in the UK. And he's been a visiting professor at Sichuan University in China, the Parami Institute in Myanmar, and he's taught in many other places besides. His latest book, Hello Stranger, will be published by Granter in July. Hannah has a PhD in creative writing from the University of Leicester and wide teaching experience inside and outside formal higher education settings in many different countries. She also has much experience working with community groups and grassroots charities. As a writer, she works in both creative nonfiction and fiction. Her short stories have been widely published in anthologies, and her first full-length collection, In Their Absence, was published by Roman Books earlier this year. Together, Hannah and Will run Wind and Bones, a community interest company which, they say, explores the meeting places between writing, creativity, and social change. And we'll find out more about that later. Will and Hannah, thanks very much for joining us. You're very welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure, Tim.
Thank you. Yes, thanks for inviting us.
We always start these conversations with a standard question that we put to everyone, whoever they are and whatever background they come from. So we'll do that with you. And I'll put it to Will first. What single word do you associate with the concept of creativity?
I think the word I'd choose would be delight. So people often like the idea of the suffering artist, but creativity, I think, needs a kind of play and pleasure and interest and intrigue and all of that kind of thing. So delight. Without delight, there's no creativity.
That's much better than the tortured creative sitting in a garret somewhere, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Hannah, what would yours be?
I would say difference. I think creativity is rooted in our individuality and our own unique experiences and perspectives on the world. And I think it's absolutely richer for that.
Well, those are both positive outlooks on creativity to start with. Hopefully that will set the tone for the rest of the conversation. Will, I'm gonna start with you and thinking about some of that diverse background that I mentioned in your profile at the beginning. You've traveled very widely around the world in person, but you've also traveled quite a long distance during your academic career. And I don't necessarily mean from Leicester to China, to Bulgaria. I mean, in terms of discipline. I wonder if you could tell us something about how creativity might be viewed and how it might be viewed differently in each of those different disciplines, and also whether your own perspective on creativity has moved as you've moved from academic focus to academic focus.
Okay, so I mean, I think it has been quite a strange itinerary, and I started out, in fact, not as an anthropologist, but as an art student. So the first 4 years of studying, I was in art school, and it didn't make me an artist, but it was an incredibly creative period. And we're going to be talking about studio spaces and things later. So during that time, I read lots, and somewhere along the way, I got embroiled in anthropology. I cobbled together some funds and I ended up in a remote village in East Indonesia after graduating. And I spent 6 months studying the work of local woodcarvers. And then I came back and did my MA in anthropology. After that, I planned to do a PhD actually in anthropology. I was determined I was going to become an anthropologist, but I crashed out due to a tropical illness I picked up in Indonesia. Then I spent a decade practicing Buddhism, and eventually the sort of lure of studying drew me back in, and I ended up doing a PhD in philosophy. So it's been a interesting itinerary, but I think my interests are pretty much still very strongly related to anthropology and philosophy. And I don't so much see myself as belonging to literary studies. I did spend the best part of a decade teaching in the English literature department until I left academia in 2016. But I never really worked out what all those literary folks were up to. And for me, and this is a theme we're going to come back to as well, writing is much more about communicating and exploring the world. And I'm not really particularly preoccupied with or bothered by questions of literature or what it is. So I tend to not see myself as belonging particularly to literary studies. In terms of academic career, I mean, and I don't really see myself anymore as having really an academic career. And I think this has certain advantages. I don't have to worry about those disciplinary boundaries. And I don't really have to worry about what creativity means in each of those camps. I also don't have to worry about what university committees decide is worthy of research. So I can kind of follow my nose a bit more and go in whatever direction I like. But in terms of my own take on creativity through all of that and through all of that journey, I think it's been fairly constant. So I see creativity as something fundamental to what makes us human. And this was one of the joys of studying anthropology early on, seeing the huge flexibility of human life, how different people organize themselves and how they go about their lives in very different ways in different places, and how our own way of doing things, and this was fascinating to me, is culturally determined. And it's only one possible way of doing things out of the infinity of ways you could. And I think also that's partly my interest in philosophy as well. I like to see the history of philosophy as the history of inventing or creating new ways of thinking about and seeing the world. So that's what's sort of interesting to me, the diversity of human ways of being and human ways of thinking, and seeing really creativity and invention as fundamental to human life. So these aren't really special skills, I think. They're not add-ons. It's not that only certain people are creative, but all human beings, I think, are naturally inventive. We're naturally creative. And that's what I'm really interested in exploring.
Great, thanks, Will. It sounds like actually your own perspective has its roots in that maybe that arts background at the very beginning, and it seems like it may have been fairly stable despite all your wandering around.
I think so. I mean, I've only begun to realise how consistent it is looking back with the benefit of hindsight. And again, I keep coming back to those 4 years in art school where at the time I thought I was simply confused by the art world, but actually now I think it was quite a formative period in terms of thinking through creativity and getting a sense of the role of creativity in human life.
Great, that also seems to suggest something positive about the transferability of creativity into different areas. On that topic, I'll turn to Hannah now. Hannah, your academic background has been somewhat more constant than Will's in terms of discipline, much more solidly rooted in English and creative writing in particular. There's sometimes a sort of prejudice about creative writing. I think on occasions this can actually come from creative writing people themselves, as well as people looking at it from without, that it sits awkwardly inside a formal academic setting, sits awkwardly on a university campus. How do you see its place within academia as a sort of discipline, if you like?
So my academic background looks quite constant, I think, on the surface at least. But the journey there for me certainly wasn't. So I'm from a working class background and went to a really deprived inner city school in Leicester, which is my hometown. Some of the teachers were exceptional there, and I did really well at GCSE, but it felt right at the time that I'd leave school, and rather than do A-levels, I'd go and do something more trade or skills related. So I actually trained as a beauty therapist when I was 16. I'm really interested in people and their experiences. So this was a good way at the time of kind of meeting lots of interesting people, but who were also ordinary, and hearing like curious insights into the lives that were happening around me. I loved English at school, but I also loved science too. And my beauty therapy qualification was very science focused. And so after my beauty therapy qualification, I actually started a biomedical science degree. And the plan there was to explore my science interests and to continue working part time. But at the time, I found the university setting quite intimidating. And I also realised that the degree, the biomedical science degree, funneled us into very narrow options, mainly quite isolated lab work. And so I dropped out because this just really didn't appeal to me. So afterwards, I worked as a beauty therapist and then as a counter assistant selling perfume in various department stores for quite a few years. And I really enjoyed working with different people and collected a lot of stories over the years, I guess. But often I was treated as though essentially I was a bit of a bimbo, not necessarily by clients, but generally when I told people what I did. And obviously after a while that really grated. So after a few years, I wanted a change. I'd started writing in an ad hoc way and wanted to study more formally. So I then did an access course in humanities at Leicester College and loved the experience. The syllabus was really broad and there were lots of interesting mature students there. It was a really good mix. And then this allowed me to go on to a degree in creative writing and English, which I also loved, particularly the creative element. And so that's how I ended up in creative writing. And that's where I eventually did my PhD as well. So it was quite an interesting journey there, I think, or here to where I am now. In terms of creative writing and formal academia, I really think creative writing needs to move away from the English department. It would be much more at home with the other artists and creators. I need time, a nice space, an interaction with people to be creative. And I think studio spaces offer all of that. I think it's a myth that writing is a solitary endeavour, certainly for me. And I don't think you can cook up your best work in a 2-hour session in a dingy classroom. So I would absolutely move creative writing into the art department, and we'd all have studio spaces to be creative and drink lots of tea together and maybe beer.
Absinthe.
You've both actually kind of touched on this already, but I will ask directly. I'll go to Will first. You both now kind of function around the edges of formal academia. Will, I noticed that you said specifically that you left academia, but you do still teach within higher education settings. Sometimes, Hannah, you do as well, but neither of you have a formal institutional affiliation. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are particular benefits to that when it comes to creativity in particular, and encouraging it and teaching it? And would that be in some way restricted if you were embedded within academia? Will, I'll ask you first.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, I think. There's a lot we like about the academic world, but also it's sometimes a hard place for creativity to thrive, I think. And we see this in some friends of ours who are academics and who complain about that themselves. But also, I think we've seen it in students. And there are various issues here. One thing about creativity is it involves experimentation, and experimentation involves risk because experiments don't always work out. But when there's a deadline looming, you know you're going to be graded, it's very easy to play it safe. So often students find themselves not experimenting, not taking risks, but just turning out something that's solid but dull. And sometimes those things, according to grading criteria, have to be marked higher than something wild but all over the place, but that contains a seed of genius. So that kind of playing it safe is often the rational choice for students, but it isn't the most creative one. I don't think this is something that is a sort of fatal problem with the academic system. You could mitigate it. So you could ditch grading for most assignments, for example, to encourage experimentation and have more portfolio-based assessment. And I think I also agree with what Hannah says about English departments. If we had our way, we would be liberated from English departments as creative writers. We'd have a model close to that of fine arts. And we'd exist in physical spaces that foster creativity. Studio spaces do that. And in my own experience, they do that in all kinds of interesting ways. But classrooms often don't. They're more monastic rather than the kind of genuine workshoppy feel of a studio space. In terms of being on the margins, we quite like being on the margins. It's a place we're at home. Being on the margins, you can experiment more. You can take risks. You have the freedom to focus on the things that we like focusing on, communication and creativity, without worrying about all those instrumental demands you have in the academic world. And there's also, I think, something, a sort of deeper thing about being on the margins. When you asked this question, I was thinking about medieval manuscripts, and you have those lines of well-copied text. But then in the margins, there are all kinds of strange illustrations. There are misbehaving animals. There are bishops and nuns getting up to all kinds of things they shouldn't. There are courtiers, there are knights. And there's this kind of flourishing of creative strangeness in the margins of those medieval manuscripts. So I think it's a nice image of how the margins are where the fun stuff often happens.
I love that idea of you both as marginalia in some kind of illuminated manuscript in the Book of Kells or something. This all leads us in the direction of Wind and Bones. So Hannah, could you tell us something about that? What was the idea behind Wind and Bones? What kind of work do you do?
Yes, so Wind and Bones. So we set up in 2017, and it was after running a series of creative writing workshops with refugees and asylum seekers back in Leicester. During the workshop, participants shared stories of their homes and journeys and experiences, both getting to Leicester and, you know, prior to that as well. And it was really moving, but it was also really fun, which I wasn't necessarily expecting. And it was just lovely to connect with people from hugely diverse backgrounds and to build a community. it became really clear during the course of these workshops how powerful a tool writing was in terms of building community, connecting different groups of people, and fostering positive social change. So we really wanted to continue doing that and doing it with all kinds of different people in different contexts as well. So as a result of that, we set up Wind and Bones. And the name comes from a medieval Chinese text on the art of writing called The Carving of Dragons and the Literary Mind. And in the text, it says that good writing needs both wind or life and energy and bones or structure and organization. And we thought this was good advice for writing, definitely, but also good advice for bringing about social change and also for life in general.
Sometimes when we tell people about our name, they ask us which of us is wind and which of us is bones, as if these are personal names, nicknames we have for ourselves.
I was actually going to say, I'm sure you get regularly asked that question. Thanks very much for sort of giving us the background on that. Will, I'll turn to you now. Obviously, in that context, you've done Wind and Bones work in a lot of different contexts. Do you find that the underpinning approaches to creativity, creative writing in particular, but creativity more generally, travel well across those often quite radically different contexts? And do you find there are any particular challenges in that?
I mean, yes, maybe it's worth just saying a few things about the context we have worked in. So
our remit is pretty broad. So we want to explore writing and creativity and see how these things can be used to make a positive difference. So I think 2018, we were invited to run some workshops and events at the Ubud Writers and Readers Festival. And then to run an 8-month writing residency in Yangon, Myanmar. So this is what really kind of kickstarted our work. And in Myanmar, we worked with grassroots educational organisations, community teaching, training colleges, and civil society organisations as well to develop their storytelling skills. And we also ran classes with journalists, former political prisoners, NGO workers, students and activists. So that was really broad.
And to come back to your question about the different contexts and the different underpinning approaches to creativity, I think it doesn't take long when you start exploring creativity in all of those different contexts before you realize that what's taken to be good, solid creative writing advice is more like a kind of rag bag of folk remedies. And those folk remedies, I mean, some of them don't work. Some of them only work for particular purposes, and they don't work everywhere as well. So different people have different bags of their own folk remedies as well.
Can I just jump in there and ask you to give me one example of one of the particular folk remedies that you found probably is one that should be consigned to the ancient past?
I think in terms of contextual specificity, we had an interesting thing with Pierre, one of our French students in Yangon.
Yes.
So he wrote a piece in English and it was okay, but it was, I think we've talked about this before, it was very florid and elaborate. And he handed it to us in English and we were like, oh my goodness, you know, what is this? Simplify, 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 and all that advice you often get on creative writing courses in English. But then we read his original version in French, which he'd almost translated directly. And in that context, that more sinuous, elaborate use of language felt totally natural. And that sort of brought home to us, I think, that there are starkly different traditions. As for if there's any sort of general advice that's given on creative writing courses that we ditch, I think maybe for me, the idea of the struggle, the creative struggle, I mean, sometimes it is a struggle, but to go back to what we were saying earlier about pleasure and play and delight, and actually ditching the idea that you must suffer.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Yeah, because I think that can really be an issue, actually, with people in creative writing workshops, for sure.
And I think so to go back to our name, Wind and Bones, which Hannah said comes from the carving of dragons and the literary mind, or the Wenxin Jiaolong, which is a Chinese text by Liu Xie. He sets out in that book a fantastic theory of creativity that's very different from the way creativity is often theorized in the Western philosophical tradition or traditions. And when I first came across that, I was kind of enchanted by it, because for Liu, writing has to come out of a kind of background ease and comfort and pleasure, and is to do with, to cultivate creativity, you have to, he talks about, nourish your vitality. And I think this is a really powerful idea in terms of how you can think differently about creativity. We don't talk to our students in universities, say in the UK or in the English speaking world, about how to nourish their vitality, but maybe that would help them a lot. So there's divergent theories of creativity as well that we stumble across as we work in all these different contexts, and as well as sort of divergent approaches to what it means to create or to tell a story.
Just on a purely practical level, you've experience of teaching now across language barriers quite often. That seems like something that would be incredibly difficult. But how has it actually worked practically?
I mean, practically, it's a lot of fun. So, working in these kind of contexts, you get various languages, various approaches to creativity, ideas of what makes a good story colliding in ways that are themselves creative. So the more we do this, go on,
Hannah. I think sometimes the kind of chaos of and kind of craziness of multiple languages and people from different backgrounds is just that kind of clash just sort of really helps to kind of generate creative possibilities and creativity in general. And just kind of thinking back to the workshop that we ran in Leicester with refugees there, we were in a church hall or a community hall in the centre of Leicester, one session, and I think there'd been an art class that had run before but had overran. So we had kind of a guy in there who was tidying up his arts equipment, and people still kind of poking around and looking at the art stuff.
Lunch was happening.
There was lunch. Then there was also, I think it was a week where the kids had been off school, and so there wasn't any available childcare. So some of the attendees had brought their children with them as well. So there was just this massive chaotic mix of things happening. Also, when we were, giving them some activities in terms of writing, and it was just, it was just chaos. But it was really, really good fun. And then we had kids on the stage who had also joined in with the creative writing activity, and they were reading their stuff, and the mums were and the dads were.
And we had also, going back to the language thing, we had Farsi, we had Swahili, we had Arabic of various flavors, we had English. And that kind of it's amazing how we think about language barriers, but also, as somebody who's traveled a lot yourself, Tim, you'll probably know that you can turn up somewhere where you don't share a language and have a great time and hang out with people there and leave. And the day after you think, oh, all those stories we shared. And then you think, well, how could we have done? But somehow communication and storytelling takes place across and between all kinds of languages. Those you speak fluently, those you speak badly, those you speak not at all. And so playing around with all of that has all kinds of creative possibilities, and maybe not worrying so much about language as a barrier is the first step towards exploring those creative possibilities in more depth.
I'm just conjuring up a wonderful image of that chaotic but wonderfully positively chaotic situation with the food and the children and the multiple languages. And of course, I mean, there's a lot more stimulus there than in one of those bleak university lecture halls that we mentioned earlier. Hannah, I'll go back to you now. I mean, it's there running through what you've talked about already in terms of what Wind and Bones does, but I did want to just narrow down on that idea of creativity and social change, creativity as a means of fostering, promoting, creating social change, because we do very often have this concept that creativity, maybe in general, but often particularly creative writing, is an individualistic thing. It's something to do with personal fulfillment, and maybe if it has a connection to social change, it's a sort of seen as a route of escape. Somebody escapes from a situation by writing their poetry or whatever, but that clearly isn't the way that you're viewing it in terms of the work you do with Wind and Bones. So could you just tell us something more about the idea of creativity, writing, and social change?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the idea of writing as being mainly about yourself and your own fulfillment is itself culturally specific, and it's also quite weird. Fulfillment doesn't come from just fulfilling yourself. It comes from connecting with other people, because obviously none of us exist in a vacuum. We all relate to other people in some way. And so with our Wind and Bones work, we start from the point of view that writing is about communication. It's about it's interpersonal first and foremost. And only after that is it personal. And I think it's amazing how little emphasis is put on this in academic approaches to creative writing. We think about the writer, we think about the text they are writing, we think about the relationship between the two, but we don't really think hard enough about writing as an act of communication. We don't think about who we're writing for and about trying to connect with human beings. So we put this centre stage in our work with Wind and Bones. And in some ways, questions of social change just naturally follow from this. If you see writing as individualistic, then it becomes very hard to see how it can change anything at all beyond our own selves. But if you see writing as interpersonal, then everything you write, every story you tell, has some kind of social impact. So with Wind and Bones, we want to foreground this question of the social nature of writing. We're storytelling animals, and storytelling is interpersonal. So we want to put center stage the fact that writing is about communication. And why do we communicate? We communicate because we want to change things. We want to make deeper links with each other. We want to persuade others of our point of view. And we want to address problems that trouble us, and so on. So this means that social change is at the heart of everything we do. It's not an add-on. It's just what stories do.
Yeah, as you say, writing is about communicating something, and well, creativity in general is about producing something that ultimately tends to be for other people, doesn't it? We're moving towards the end now. We could go on much longer, but I have a couple of standard questions that we do put to everyone. So I'll put them again to the both of you. I'll start with Will on this one. As educators in a broader general sense, what can we do specifically, if you could narrow it down to certain maxims, to promote a culture of creativity beyond any specific subject and to cultivate students' creative ability?
I mean, for me, the first thing is probably trust. So, which I think is a fundamental aspect of human relationships as well. But creative writing training is often based on a kind of mistrust of where people are coming from. So you have to add in skills they don't have. You have to tell them how to do stuff because they don't know how to do stuff. But I think really our approach is to have a deeper trust in the fact that people are already creative, and to go back to what I was saying earlier, that fundamental human creativity is a fundamental aspect of human life, is really at the heart of what we do. So this is a trust in individuals. And I think there's no such thing as an uncreative person. Occasionally working in universities, I had students who would come in and say, I'm not creative. And, you know, you just think, well, how could this be? You're a human being. Of course you are. So it's you have to dismantle those ideas of creativity that are unhelpful so people can learn to trust their own inherent creativity. But I think it's also, this trust is a trust in the fundamental flexibility, playfulness, the power of invention that we all have just by being human and being, you know, having human brains and living in society and all of that. So our job as creative writing workshop leaders, as mentors and everything else we do, is really, as we see it, to point people to the thing that's already there rather than giving them something they haven't yet, adding creativity in as if it's something they haven't yet got.
Yeah, so I was just going to kind of add to that. I think sort of first and foremost, we aim to set a tone of friendliness, like within our sessions, with minimum hierarchy, so that people can really connect with us and each other just on a really human level. Because I think there are some really terrible creative writing classes out there where the great and often male writer hands down judgments on students' work like some minor god. But I think as a general approach to teaching creative writing, it's absolutely terrible. So instead, we start from establishing this friendliness and trust and get people talking, get them sharing stories, seeing the effect of their storytelling on each other. And then from that beginning, absolutely amazing, you know, creative stuff starts to happen.
And one thing to add there actually is, in terms of our method, when we say we get people talking, sharing stories, we are actually talking about talking and sharing stories. So often in our classes, we won't write for the first few hours. We'll get people face to face, connecting on a human level and seeing what connects. And then after that, we'll see how we can translate the life of that interpersonal connection into their writing.
Right. I have one final question, another one that sort of narrows down to one small thing, a bit like the question at the beginning. I'll put it to you, Will, and then we'll go to Hannah. If you had a magic wand and could change one thing about education to foster creativity, what would it be?
I think for me, there was always kind of lots of anxiety in education around assessment and grading. And I think for me, it would be to remove all of that. I'm not sure kind of ultimately kind of what the kind of system or process then of education would look like. But I think, being marked and graded is such a barrier to learning and creativity as well, definitely. So that would be one of my things, I think.
And I think for me, what I would do with my magic wand is I would create a much broader plurality of well-funded contexts in which education and learning could happen. So it, alongside universities, which we're often quite fixated on, and they have definitely have their virtues, I would see the flourishing of well-funded adult education centres where people could go and learn simply for the sake of learning, and really a myriad of interventions of little pools of creativity and learning that that are, you know, well-funded and that are supporting this kind of creativity. And I think that particularly adult education is one of the things I believe in very strongly, and I think is often overlooked.
Yes, that's a good one.
Right, I'll get to work on that creative magic wand, then. As I said, we could very easily go on for another hour, but unfortunately we're out of time. But before we do finish, you are of course both creative practitioners, so I should make sure that you have a little opportunity to tell us about your most recent work, whatever your most recent publications or works in progress are. Hannah, I know you have a new book out, and I believe several other things in the pipeline. Would you like to just tell us what you've been up to?
I do, I would. As you mentioned at the start, my short story collection, In Their Absence, was published early this year by Roman Books. And it's a collection of short stories based on the theme of missing people, which is actually a huge issue in the UK. So in the UK, about 176,000 people are reported missing every year, which is obviously huge. And the reasons for people going missing hugely vary. So through my collection, I aim to explore the human complexities of that. And I actually researched the phenomenon of missing people extensively during my PhD. So this collection resulted from this. Currently I'm working on a new short story collection which has a working title of On the Bodies of Strangers, and this is a collection loosely linked by the theme of tattoos, and has been lots of fun so far, so that's good. And then in terms of Wind and Bones projects, later this year we'll be working on a writing and storytelling project with survivors of domestic abuse. We're partnering with an excellent Sofia-based organisation called Improve, and the project is funded by the British Embassy here in Sofia. So we're really excited about that.
Excellent. And Will, I believe you have a new book in the, yes, in the offing.
There's all kinds of projects in the works. So alongside, in terms of Wind and Bone stuff, we've got new courses. So we've just published a couple of weeks ago a new online course on non-fiction writing, which we're very excited about because it's self-study, but it's also self-study where people get ongoing feedback and mentoring and support. So it's a nice blended model. So that's on our website, courses.windandbones.com. But also writing lots, and the next book, Hello Stranger, How We Find Connection in a Disconnected World, is coming out from Granta on July the 1st. I'm very excited this week because it's just been featured as editor's choice for July nonfiction in the bookseller. And this is a book that's been a long time in the making that draws together all that interest in philosophy and anthropology and history and even literature to explore what it means to connect with strangers and how we can build more welcoming societies and more welcoming lives, and can forge those connections that are really at the basis of anything of value in the world, I think. So Hello Stranger is coming out this summer, and there's quite a lot to do with that. I'm also working on another non-fiction book, which is around our ideas of our twitchy relationship we have as human beings with the future. You know, we both want to know what the future is going to be like. We have all kinds of weird ways of trying to work that out, but we also don't want to know because we want to be surprised. And the tension between those two things is interesting. So another big theme non-fiction book, which I'm calling Taming the Future.
Excellent. Well, we'll look out for that one and for your next collection as well, Hannah. Thanks so much, both of you, for joining us today. The conversation could have run on and on and on into the future, but we are sadly out of time. So thank you once again for joining us. It's been brilliant and stimulating, and we'll see you at some point down the line, I'm sure.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks, Dylan.
Yeah, total pleasure. Thank you.